Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Sloan. Our three-part series revolving around the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing kicks off with a show about a three-part series. Our guest is Robert Stone. His new three-part film, Chasing the Moon, airs on the PBS history series The American Experience starting July 8th. It's an engaging film featuring rare, never-before-seen footage and stories that tell the oft-told tale of the halcyon days of NASA during the 1960s in a unique way that features many of the social issues of the 60s, from civil and women's rights to the Vietnam War and how John F. Kennedy's goal of reaching the moon before 1970 was affected by and at times insulated from those social forces. The first two installments take us through the early period of the space program as America responds to the challenge posed by the Soviet Union, which launched the first Earth-orbiting satellite, Sputnik, in 1957. Finally, the film examines the Apollo 11 mission, but looks at it through the lens of how people around the world experience the mission on radio and television. So let's get to it and talk to the creator of Chasing the Moon, Robert Stone. Welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. I'm really great. Really happy to be here.
What I love about this film is that it looks at the Apollo program through many different lenses, socially, politically, historically, you know, and the technical and science side. You know, you hear this phrase a lot, thought-provoking. And what I loved about your film is you provoked me to think about something, you know, that I thought I fully understood, but there were aspects of it that I realized I really didn't.
Well, that's great. I mean, that was really my motivation going in, because, you know, I too have seen a lot of documentaries about this over the years. And I agree, some are very good. A lot of them are not so good. But I felt there was an opening here to do something different, because so many of the films have really focused on the astronaut experience. And in terms of the visuals, have really almost exclusively focused on the NASA footage, which is quite extensive, and people are still finding new things. We certainly found a lot of new things, even in the NASA collection. But I felt that nothing that I've ever seen really captured what I remember the experience to have been. I was 10 years old when it happened. I'd seen 2001 about a year before, which kind of blew my mind and was a film that made me want to be a filmmaker. And my entire childhood was spent in anticipation of this event happening. And to me, I felt that the main event was here on Earth. And that was something that had been largely forgotten. And I've racked my brains about why. And I think what happened is that after we landed on the moon, you know, the story that we didn't know was the story of the astronauts. So that's the story that got told. And it's been told again and again and again. And the ground controllers. But now we're, you know, most people have no living memory of the moon landing. So the experience of what it was like here on Earth to be alive at a time when we were leaving the Earth for the first time and going off to another world, and the sense of optimism and possibilities that engendered was really something that had not been covered in a documentary. And I felt that that was the key thing that I wanted to impart. I've got two teenage sons, and to impart to them. And to put this all in a context so they could really understand it and hopefully get something out of it that they might apply to their own lives.
I was 9 when this happened, so right about the same age as you were, and saw 2001, A Space Odyssey, at the Cinerama Dome in Hollywood when it first came out, and was just blown away by that film, as you were. I'd like to ask you, when did you decide to pursue this? What you know, I know the 50th anniversary and everything, you know, is coming up, but this is pretty well traveled ground. When did you decide you wanted to pursue this, and what was the impetus for that?
Well, this is an idea that's been kicking around in my head for an awfully long time. I'd made a shorter film about the sort of post-Sputnik era about 30 years ago. And I knew, from that experience, I knew that there was a ton of archival footage that had never been seen and never really been sourced. And it was just something I always knew I wanted to return to. And when I saw that the the 50th anniversary is coming up, I saw an opportunity to do a big and expansive movie. I never imagined it was going to turn into 6 hours at the time, but to do something, you know, profoundly different about the cultural, the social, political context in which this all took place. And I knew that there was all of this footage that nobody sourced before. So, and I also knew that many of the people involved were getting very old. And, you know, we've lost several of the people I interviewed have already passed away since I interviewed them. So I thought that I should get started. And that was 5 years ago. So I've been at this, I've been working full time on this for 5 years.
Wow. And tell me about the process of pitching this to WGBH and the American Experience.
Well, it's interesting. You know, it was 5 years ago and I was talking about the 50th anniversary of the moon landing coming up, and I took it around to all the networks and the usual suspects of Netflix and Amazon and, you know, Discovery and Nash Geo and everybody, you know, and I got turned down by everybody, to be honest with you. It was all, oh, nobody cares about history and the 50th, it's so far away. You know, it was kind of, nobody thought that this was going to be a big deal. Of course, it has turned into a huge deal, as you know. And I finally went to PBS that I've got a long working relationship with for many, many years. And I said, look, I really want to do this film and I really got to get started because it's going to take me a long time. This is a big project. And they embraced it and gave me incredible leeway. You know, I pitched it to them as a 2-hour film. I showed them the first hour. They said, you know, this should be a 4-hour film. And I showed them the second hour. They said, you know, this should be a 6-hour film. So they just let it grow. They gave me the resources. They gave me the time. And I don't think any other network or broadcaster would have given me the level of support and the backing that I got from PBS. I'm incredibly grateful to them.
There's a lot of footage in the first episode that I remember from an American Experience program years ago that I just dearly loved. It was called The Satellite Sky.
Yeah, that's my film.
That's your film.
That's the one I was talking about, yeah.
I love that film so much, and I've never been able to find it anywhere.
It totally disappeared. But we sourced, that was sort of the backbone for the first hour, at least, of Chasing the Moon. It's so funny that you know that. Not too many people remember that film.
Because I was going to bust you. It's like, wow, I saw this on the Satellite Sky.
No. Right. But I can rip myself off, right? I think that's allowed to rip yourself off.
Oh, I love that film so much because it had no narration.
Right.
It was just you're watching this all unfold, and I dearly loved it. And I've been trying to find it for years. And then I started watching this, and I'm like, oh my gosh, there's all that stuff I love from The Satellite Sky.
That's so funny.
Thanks for bringing it back.
That's so funny. But yeah, it was the experience of making that you know, all of the footage I accumulated in making that film, I've been carrying around with me for 30 years, thinking, you know, one day I got to go back and source this again and really expand on this, because it was just it was an amazing, you know, that's just like, I think, a 52-minute film, but it opened the floodgates to me for what's out there.
Way cool. Well, there's so many parts of that I love, but my favorite, which is in your film, I don't know why I love this so much, but there's a nightclub singer and she's in, I think, in Cocoa Beach. He's locked up in that capsule. He can't get away.
That's right.
I just thought that was hilarious. It just, you catch the kitsch and the campiness of the 1960s and the culture around Cape Canaveral. And, you know, this was just a sleepy little town, and then NASA descends upon it and the astronauts, and it becomes, you know, ground zero for the space race.
Yeah, I really wanted to capture the magic of this place. It just, like, you know, it's one of those, you know, I think, you know, everybody has this, you know, if you could go back in time, you know, where would you want to be? I think, you know, maybe London in 1966, but I think Cocoa Beach in 1962 would be one of them, you know.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. Everybody there said it's just one of the greatest experiences of their lives, being there in the early days of the space program, when just there was this just, it was all new, and everybody was very young, and they were drinking an awful lot, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah. And it really was the new frontier of John F. Kennedy.
Yep.
There's a lot of really great stories in here, but some I wanted to talk to you about. The first one is the story of Ed Dwight. And Ed White, the astronaut who was the first to walk in space and tragically dies on the Apollo 1 fire. How did you come across his story? Because it's a really powerful story about who should have probably been America's first African-American astronaut.
Yeah, it's an incredible story. I knew nothing about it going into this. My senior historical researcher, Alan Andrus, who's also the co-author of the book with me, he discovered this story. We tracked him down. He lives in Denver. He's actually a world-famous sculptor these days. He totally, you know, went off in a completely different and unexpected direction. And he had this incredible story that had really not been told. And we were able to find footage of him from that time. He was recruited by the Kennedy administration because they saw the space program as something that was about projecting the very best of America to the rest of the world, particularly the developing world, which was throwing off the shackles of colonialism and was deciding, you know, is the Soviet Union the wave of the future? Should we go with them? Or is the United States the wave of the future? And President Kennedy, in this instance, at the urging of Edward R. Murrow, the famed CBS News broadcaster, who is his head of the USIA, suggested that it would be a propaganda boon, really, to have a black astronaut as part of the early astronaut corps. And also Kennedy was interested in supporting the burgeoning civil rights crusade that was going on. And so that factored into it as well. They found this guy. He was an ace fighter pilot. He had an advanced degree in aeronautical engineering. He qualified. They sent him out to Edwards Air Force Base to train with Chuck Yeager. Anybody who's seen the movie The Right Stuff will remember what that's about. And he ran into a lot of opposition, really from Yeager and from others who really did not see, put it this way, they did not see the space program in the same way that Kennedy saw it. If, to them, it was just an engineering adventure, really. It was, can we get to the moon? They didn't even want television cameras on the flights. It was just like, okay, you want us to go to the moon? We'll go to the moon. They didn't see any value in expanding the astronaut corps to include African Americans, women, anybody. It was just a mission that they were on. They resented it. They resented his presence. And he didn't end up making it into the astronaut corps, but he became a huge celebrity in the black press at the time. It was a very big deal for African Americans, and to the point where when another astronaut named Ed White, who was white, became the first American to walk in space, many African Americans thought that it was Ed Dwight who had done that. Of course, the pictures on Life magazine, you know, you can't see his face. He's covered with a space helmet. And Ed tells this wonderful story where Ed White, after he came back, presented Ed Dwight with these two boxes of mail that he'd received. And he said, now I understand why it's important for you to go into space. And it's a very touching moment in the film.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlohm. After a short break, we'll continue our interview with filmmaker Robert Stone. His new three-part documentary, Chasing the Moon, examines the early days of the space program up through the first moon landing in July of 1969. It airs on the PBS series The American Experience next week. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now with our conversation with documentary filmmaker Robert Stone. His new film, Chasing the Moon, airs on The American Experience on PBS July 8th through the 10th. you know, there's the civil rights story and all of the different social things going on in the 1960s, the Vietnam War, the women's movement. You weave those through this story because, from my understanding, a lot of the astronauts and the people involved in NASA, they're so absorbed in what they're doing about trying to meet Kennedy's goal of getting us to the moon by 1969, the end of the decade, that they're kind of unaware of what's going on in society. And one of the most poignant moments in the film for me was the story of Ralph Abernathy at Kennedy Space Center when Apollo 11's about to launch, and the NASA administrator at that time, Tom Paine, coming out to meet him.
Well, one of the most pervasive myths about the space race and the Apollo program is this idea that Kennedy gets up and gives this rousing speech, Congress appropriates money, and NASA gets to work, and the public support behind it, and off we went. And, you know, we were so great then, and we're not now. I think that is kind of a myth about Apollo. In fact, the truth of the matter is, majority of Americans supported the idea of the space program, but a majority of the Americans did not think it was worth the money. The only time when it went above 50% support for spending and people saying it's worth the cost was a tiny little blip around the time of Apollo 8, the first mission around the moon, and Apollo 11, the first mission to land on the moon. But for the rest of the time, a minority of Americans thought it was worth the cost. And I think one of the greatest accomplishments of the Apollo program, as much as it was a technical achievement, it was an incredible achievement in following through on a goal that the government has presented to sustain public and political support over the course of a decade was an amazing and very difficult achievement, as challenging as it was to put a man on the moon, I would venture to say. So what happened at the time of Apollo 11 was that Ralph Abernathy, who sort of succeeded Martin Luther King as the symbolic head of the civil rights movement in the wake of King's assassination in April 1968, he led a march to Cape Kennedy on the eve of the launch of Apollo 11 to demonstrate about America's priorities. You know, why are we spending $24 billion to put a man on the moon when there are people in America going to bed hungry every night? And it was a legitimate thing to say. But he also couched it in terms of, you know, that he was proud of what they were doing as an American. He was proud as an American, but he was there to question our priorities. And it's a very poignant moment. And I think it demonstrates to me, I think one of the great lessons of Apollo is that it kind of spread, I don't know if it spread this optimism, but it certainly symbolized the kind of optimism that we associate with that period. So even people who were against the space program, as Abernathy was, and many Americans were, particularly African Americans, who saw it as a waste of money. And because Ed Dwight was not a part of it, had felt, you know, excluded from the adventure. The sense of possibility that the future would be better than the present and the past, that anything could be accomplished, and that any goal we set, we can reach. That sense of optimism spread among people, whether they were for the space program or not. If you were an environmental activist or a women's rights activist or a civil rights activist, the sense that tomorrow is going to be better than today was pervasive at that time. I think it's something that we've lost. And I think in part we've lost it because we haven't demonstrated an ability to get together and do something collectively as a nation on this scale ever since. I think we're missing that. But to me, that's the real lesson of Apollo.
Well, of course, Apollo 11 and the Saturn V were launched from Launch Complex 39A, and I was thinking about that before we spoke today. And the word complex came to mind, is that this is a complex story, and no one story is any more complex than if you look at the architect of the Saturn V, Wernher von Braun. Because you want to talk about a complicated story, you know, a guy who was a Nazi and perhaps a war criminal, and yet he designs these massive rockets, the greatest rocket ever flown. and amazingly, not a single Saturn rocket, either the 1B or the Saturn V, none of them ever failed, really.
Wernher von Braun is the probably, I would say, the central character who runs right through the entire six-hour series. To me, he's one of the most fascinating and complex characters of the 20th century. And it's extraordinary to me that here we are on the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, and he's largely forgotten. There's really nothing being said about him. There's no celebration of his work. There's no real, he's just forgotten. And at the time in the 1950s and 1960s, he was the most well-known public scientist of his day. And he led the program. I mean, it just could not have happened without his dogged determination. And the complexity of his story, you know, the sort of Faustian bargain he struck to fulfill his dream of sending humans into space, first with Hitler. Developing the first ballistic missiles, the V-2, which was used at the end of World War II against London and Antwerp. And then coming to the United States after the war and going to work for the Army developing intercontinental ballistic missiles, while at the same time working with Walt Disney to sell the American people on the idea that space travel was not something that existed only in the realm of science fiction, that could actually happen. And then, of course, when Sputnik happens in 1957, the first satellite launched by the Soviet Union, and then particularly after the Russians launched the first man into space in 1961, Yuri Gagarin, Kennedy is casting about, you know, what can I do? What can I do? We're, you know, as a nation, we're being humiliated by this country we thought was a sort of a backwoods, second-rate power. And here they are launching people into space. And it was von Braun who told Kennedy, look, we can't, they've got bigger rockets than we have. They're ahead of us, and they're going to be ahead of us for a long time. But we need to move the goalposts. So let's set a goal that's so audacious and so crazy that both the Russians and the Americans will have to start from an even playing field and build a whole new series of rockets. And he had this Saturn rocket that he had developed. And that's why Kennedy said, let's go to the moon. And at the time, nobody knew how to do it. There were materials that needed to be invented. Nobody had ever linked up two spacecrafts in orbit. Nobody knew how to do it. But the goal was set. And it's really important to remember, the goal was set, and the goal forced it to happen because the nation's prestige was on the line.
It's interesting, too, to think about Kennedy's arc throughout this, because when he sets the goal to land a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth before the decade is out, that he delivers, you know, 3 weeks after Alan Shepard's first 15-minute flight, which doesn't even go into orbit, you know, he starts to have second thoughts about this, realizing how much it's going to cost. And is this really a good idea politically? Do I really want to do this? And it's interesting that, you know, when 1963 rolls around and he pays a visit to Wernher von Braun and sees the Saturn engines being tested, you can see that he's fully on board by the time he's assassinated.
Kennedy saw this entirely through the prism of the Cold War. Yeah, you're entirely right. He had no real interest in space per se. He didn't really campaign on the issue other than to suggest that the Republican administration under Eisenhower and by extension Nixon, who he was running against, was weak because the Soviets were doing all these space spectaculars and we weren't. But he didn't really have an interest in space exploration at all. And it's interesting to note also, which we show in the film, 6 weeks after giving his famous, the first moon speech where he says, we're going to put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. 6 weeks after that, he goes to Vienna and has his one and only meeting with Soviet Premier Khrushchev and suggests that they do a joint mission to the moon because he's so freaked out about the cost, the budget estimates of what it's going to cost and whether they'd even succeed. And Khrushchev rebuffs him. And then in September 63, after the Cuban Missile Crisis and things have sort of changed with the Russians, are more secure in their own right about their technological abilities with missiles. And Khrushchev has taken a liking to Kennedy and respects him. Kennedy goes to the United Nations and makes a speech, which is, we have it in the film, I've never seen it before, where he proposes a joint mission to the moon with the Russians. And what we discovered through Soviet Premier Khrushchev's son was that about a month before President Kennedy was killed, Khrushchev, through back channels, agreed and said, yeah, let's do it. Because Khrushchev, too, was really concerned about bankrupting his country, racing to the moon. And he thought this would be a great, both of them wanted to wind down the tensions of the Cold War. But of course, Kennedy is assassinated on November 22nd, 63. And 9 months later, Khrushchev was overthrown. And it never came to pass. But it's one of the great what ifs.
Yeah. And of course, the death of John F. Kennedy, you know, you could almost say the martyrdom, you know, that takes place, as I recall from being a child, you know, just that was such a traumatic experience for my family and them telling me about it and watching documentaries about him as a kid. That really does provide this real push to meet his goal, to like honor this slain president by getting us to the moon by the end of the decade.
No, there's no question that provided a kind of emotional underpinning whenever NASA was going to Congress to get more money to fulfill this goal, that certainly this was seen, you know, Kennedy's wish must be fulfilled. Although I think just laying down the benchmark of doing it before the end of the decade was enough of a putting our nation's prestige on the line to have provided the impetus. But certainly, yeah, I agree that his martyrdom in that sense definitely made it more likely that it was going to come to fruition for sure.
And of course, it was not without difficulty. And the most difficult moment of all happened in January of 1967, and the Apollo 1 fire that killed the astronauts Gus Grissom and Ed White, who we talked about earlier, and Roger Chaffee, who was one of the U-2 pilots during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And one of the things I found really kind of jarring in a really good way was your footage of Doris Day. That you show right before that. Could you tell us a bit about how you found that?
Yeah, it's an incredible piece of footage where there were all kinds of problems with the contractor for the first Apollo space capsule that ended up being the cause of the death of those three astronauts in the Apollo 1 fire, which took place on the launch pad, by the way, in a test. And we found this footage of that Doris Day did, which was, it was a public service commercial of sorts that was done while she was making a film called The Glass Bottom Boat, which was filmed at a lot of NASA facilities, a totally forgettable movie.
Which I remember.
Yeah, you enough. Remember. Yeah. Oh, that is odd, but you remember the satellite sky too. So they did this short little movie to tell the contractors who are working on the spacecraft to be extra, extra careful. And they do this little movie scenes like, well, when we're in a movie, you know, we can, if we screw things up, we got another take and another take and another take. If you're sending a rocket to the moon, you got to get it right on the first take. And what I love about it is it's 6 months later, you could never have made this little piece of film. It was done right before the Apollo 1 fire. And it really captures this moment in a kind of weird, intangible way that I just love.
Kind of the naivete of like, oh, you know, no, this is incredibly dangerous. And on the first take, we're going to actually kill these astronauts.
Right. Yeah. I mean, what's forgotten is if you look at the whole history of this project without the benefit of hindsight, if you really sort of follow the history as it happened, which we do in the film by using so much contemporaneous news reporting of what goes on, what was going on. First of all, you find all of these what ifs. Well, okay, it looks like we're going to do a joint mission to the moon. Oh, it looks like we're going to have a black astronaut. You know, all these paths that are forgotten because they didn't pan out are fascinating. They're fascinating to me, and I hope they're fascinating to the audience. But also is how many times it appeared that this whole program was just not going to happen. Things were behind schedule. Things were not working out. Nobody knew how to get to the moon. is way over a budget, is way behind the schedule. And then three astronauts are killed in the launch pad. The public's lost interest. The public's moved on. All of these things. And yet problems were surmounted one after another after another. Public support was sustained enough to get it over the finish line. And it's a remarkable story. And so many of these things get forgotten because it eventually worked out so well. Everything went so right. One forgets the degree to which we were all on pins and needles that everything was going to go wrong, you know, because of everything that had led up to it. It was there was no certainty that they were going to pull this off. And the fact that, you know, people we talked to just were shocked when they actually landed on the moon on their first take.
I forget who it was, but in the film, there's even, you have someone saying, holy S word, you know, we actually landed on the first try.
So we can say that on PBS, but not on NPR.
Not on NPR, no.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many wonderful things about this program, but there's one thing that just really stood out to me, because I watched it three times, and each time I watched it, this stood out to me more and more, is just what an incredible badass, I will say that, Frank Borman is.
Yeah, he's the man.
He is just amazing, and he says some things like in there, he calls Chuck Yeager out, you know, who does that? Frank Borman does. You know, he says he was a piece of work.
Yep.
And he tells Richard Nixon in the Oval Office, it's like, look, you know, while they're watching the Apollo 11 mission together, you better get ready to tell those wives, you know, that they're widows. You've got to be prepared for that. And by the way, you really had nothing to do with this. You know, this wasn't your goal,
right.
You know, and just the respect I have for that man is just immense. I heard a story that didn't he offer you some film?
Yeah. Yes, he did. Frank occasionally calls me up out of the blue and it's like, God, I'm talking to Frank Borman. He's an incredible human being. He, to the audience members who don't know who he is, he commanded the first mission that left the orbit of the Earth and went out and circumnavigated the moon in 1968. And yes, so we were interviewing Frank Borman. I should add that the film has no talking heads. We did audio only interviews. So there's no seesaw back and forth, past and present. So we did an audio only interview with Frank. We spent a lovely day with him. And he's driving us to the airport to catch our flight home. He lives out in Montana. And he just casually mentions to me, he said, you know, Robert, I got a bunch of rolls of 35 millimeter motion picture film in my closet that's been sitting around since the Apollo days. Do you want it? I was like, are you kidding me? Turn the car around right now. Let's go back, please. So we go back to his house and he pulls out this huge box of film. And indeed, they are like big 1,000-foot reels of 35 millimeter motion picture film in these rusty old cans. And gives it to me. So it was way too heavy to get on a plane. So we raced over to FedEx, barely made our flight home. Long story short, get this stuff, take it into New York City to Technicolor to look at it and get it digitized. And there before my eyes is pristine, absolutely beautiful, looks like a Hollywood movie, of footage shot inside Frank Borman's home on the day that he launched to the moon. All the astronaut wives are there. His wife is there freaking out because she was best friends with Ed White's wife, widow, who is also in the room.
And she was convinced that, you know, there was a really good chance that Frank was going to die. I think asked.
She was convinced. She was convinced he was going to die.
She asked Chris Kraft, you know, lay it on me. What are the odds that they're going to make it back? And I think he said 50-50. And she said, that good. Well, that makes me feel better. She was really freaked out.
Well, understand that the Saturn V had only been launched three times. No.
Twice.
Only twice before. And these were the first men to ride it. And they were the first people to ever leave the Earth orbit and their first to ever go around the moon and all the maneuverings to do that and make it back safely. And remember, too, they had no life raft.
No lunar module.
They had no lunar module, which was the thing when Apollo 13 went wrong. It was the fact that they had the lunar module that allowed them to get home safely. So this was the most daring and dangerous mission ever in space. And Frank commanded that. He also led the investigation into the Apollo 1 fire that produced a much better spacecraft than what was originally built. But this footage is so great because you really see, without having to say anything, the toll that this adventure took on the families of these astronauts. You see it on their faces.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with filmmaker Robert Stone. His new three-part series, Chasing the Moon, airs on PBS's The American Experience next week. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. You are listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we talk to filmmaker Robert Stone about his new three-part documentary, Chasing the Moon, which chronicles the early Cold War-fueled space program from Sputnik up to the triumphant Apollo 11 moon landing 50 years ago this month.
The footage looks so real. I mean, well, it's so vibrant that many people I showed it to when I first got it, thought it was a reenactment. They couldn't believe it was real. So we actually ended up including a lot of the slates, the beeps, to synchronize the sound that they used in those days. Just to remind the audience that this is actually a real piece of footage and not a Hollywood reenactment.
Who shot that?
It was shot, I don't know the cameraman's name, but the producer was a guy named Francis Thompson. If you got a second, it's a very interesting story. Francis Thompson was an Academy Award-winning filmmaker in New York, and he had this grand ambition to make the penultimate film about Apollo 11. And he got access to this scene during Apollo 8, which was 6 months before Apollo 11, to kind of demonstrate, you know, what he could do. He was just there for like 6 hours or so in this house. And he went off to Hollywood and tried to get a ridiculous amount of money for his movie. And they all turned him down. And I think he just got mad and just like gave up and gave the footage to Frank and walked away and went on with his life. Now, about 3 months before Apollo 11, Julian Scheer, who was the head of public relations for NASA, called up Francis Thompson and said, please, you know, we can't do another sort of hackneyed NASA movie about Apollo 11. This is the first guys to walk on the moon. Will you please do something? I've got $350,000. And Francis said, no, I'm not interested in that. It's not big enough for me. But you can hire my editor. He'll make the movie for you. And his head editor turned out to be an incredible filmmaker in his own right, a guy named Theo Kamecki, who I also interviewed. And Theo Kamecki proceeded to make this movie that ended up becoming a film called Moonwalk 1 that we use a lot of in the film. And it was the outtakes of Theo's film that were discovered that were part of the Apollo 11 documentary that came out this year.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That's Theo's outtakes. Yeah.
It's a gold mine that you found there. I was just amazed by that footage and very moved by it. And one of the wonderful stories I want people to know is that, you know, Frank Borman is still flying, you know, in his 90s doing civil air patrol for fire spotting in Montana. The guy's just amazing. And the crew of Apollo 8, Frank Borman and Bill Anders and Jim Lovell, those are like, I think they're the only three marriages that have survived all of this time. They're still married to their wives. Susan is still married to Frank. Valerie's still married to Bill, and Marilyn is still married to Jim Lovell.
Extraordinary, isn't it? And they were all on the one mission, yeah. And everybody else got divorced.
Oh God, yeah, those missions were incredibly hard on marriages.
Well, not just the mission. It was the fact that, you know, we deal with this quite frankly in the movie. These guys, they were young fighter pilots and they were away from their families. The families lived in Houston. The astronauts spent the majority of their time in Florida at Cape Canaveral. And Cape Canaveral, as we discussed earlier, was quite a party town. Mm-hmm. And there were space groupies everywhere.
The cookies.
Ah. So it was a tough thing to hold a marriage together in that environment. So kudos to those three guys and their wives to have got through that and survived all these years and happily.
Well, 180 degrees away from that, you also have a central character in your story, the wonderful Poppy Northcutt from Mission Control, the only woman. She was a very young woman at the time, wasn't she?
She was 27 years old at the time of Apollo 8, yes, that year. She was 27 years old. She's got just an amazing story, and she's been out on the road doing press with us. She's just a rock star. She worked for a contractor, a NASA contractor, TRW, working on the Return to Earth software, which was the computer program that allowed the astronauts to do these very complicated maneuvers around the backside of the moon and to point their spaceship accurately so they would return to Earth. Because if you burned your rocket for like a half a second longer than was required, you'd miss the Earth entirely. It was a very complicated thing that had to be done using computers. And that's what she worked on. She was very beautiful. She looked like Sybil Shepherd. She got a lot of media attention. But she also became quite radicalized as a feminist working in this a caricature of a macho environment. You know, I mean, when you think of macho environments, Mission Control would be sort of the penultimate. So I was great fun for me as a filmmaker to tell this oft-told story of what was going on in Mission Control through the eyes of the one woman who was there. And she's got a great story, not only as a software engineer and a NASA engineer, but also just as a woman coming of age in this time when the women's movement is really heating up. And the experience, it's her radicalization as a feminist is being informed by her experience in this macho world of Mission Control, where she was paid much less than everybody around her. She ended up founding the Houston chapter of the National Organization for Women and went on to become a national board member for now as well. And is quite well known in Texas for her advocacy for women.
Yeah, like you said, she's a rock star. Another thing that I really appreciated about this film, especially like after watching First Man, is that your portrayal and the inclusion of the second man, Buzz Aldrin, is extremely sympathetic and shows the human side of Buzz that a lot of times gets overlooked. If you want to briefly share some of that with us, because that was very touching.
Buzz was incredibly gracious. I think he's been misunderstood. When he came back from the moon, he suffered from depression very badly.
Alcoholism,
and became one of the first people to speak out publicly about depression in the early 70s, when this was not something that anybody, you know, talked about. And what we demonstrated, what we show in the film is that 6 months before he went to the moon, his mother killed herself tragically, which he, you know, true or not, he felt somewhat responsible for, in that she was very upset about the publicity that came at her after the after her son was in Gemini 12, and she saw that, you know, her son was going to be an Apollo astronaut going to the moon, and her last name was Moon, her maiden name. Yeah. And she was a very, very private person. He tells that story. I don't want to say much more about it because I don't know all the details and I don't presume to.
No,
but it's important to know that these astronauts all had personal experiences with their parents, with their children, with their wives. And they had to put on this face, this public face, and be out there Oftentimes, you know, in a situation where they, none of them were prepared for this at all. They weren't prepared for celebrity. They were fighter pilots. They were trained to do a job.
For you, Robert, what's the legacy of the Apollo program? Because you've poured a lot of yourself into this film. What's the big takeaway for you?
I think for me, it's really a reminder that even in times that are as divisive and polarized as what we live through now, that it is possible for us to, you know, put aside our differences, and necessary to put aside our differences, and come together and be part of something that's bigger than ourselves. I think there's a real hunger for that. I think there's a hunger on the part of young people to be a part of something bigger than themselves. And what we're lacking is leadership who will call them to that. And, you know, I, from my personal point of view, I think climate change is the great task for us to tackle. And I think there's millions of people who are just awaiting the leadership to do something as bold and audacious as what Kennedy said in going to the moon. And maybe it might seem impossible, just as going to the moon. We had no idea how to do it. But by setting down that benchmark and making us all feel like we were personally had a personal vested interest in every step of the way and its success or failure was really empowering. And it as I said earlier, it created this sort of infectious sense of optimism about the future and that we can do anything that got inside the heads of even those people who were against the space program. So that's the lesson, I think. That's why I think the context in which Apollo took place is so important. You can't really understand what it was about or glean anything from it for the present if you just look at it like a climbing Mount Everest or something. I get back to my initial impulse in making the film is it's about us. This is a story about us. Yeah, it's a story about the astronauts. They had their experience, but that's a unique thing. But mostly, it's what it did for us here on Earth that's important.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to let you go. But my big takeaway was something that Poppy Northcutt said, where she said one of the joys is that everybody felt like they had a part of the space program, and they did. And I still feel that way, and because I get to talk to people like you.
I still feel that way, too.
Well, thank you so much, Robert Stone, and thanks for this wonderful film. I hope everybody gets to watch it on the American Experience on their PBS channel. It's an awesome experience. It's really like going back in time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Robert. You can catch Robert Stone's documentary, Chasing the Moon, starting Monday, July 8th on PBS Television's The American Experience. Check your local listings for airtimes. Now it's time for a new segment on Blue Dot, where from time to time, we'll strive to help you gain a better understanding of some kinds of natural phenomena or concepts that you think you might know, but on further inspection, you discover that maybe you don't. Our new producer, Matt Fidler, came up with the concept, and we're calling it Blue Dot's Teachable Moment. So here's Matt.
This is the Teachable Moment with Dave Shloem, where we get answers to those burning scientific questions that sometimes linger in the back of our heads. I'm Matt Fidler. Hey, Dave, how you doing? Are you ready to do this?
Yeah, Matt. What would people like to know about this week?
Well, since your show is called Blue Dot, we thought we should know this basic question. Why is the sky blue?
Ooh, that's a great question. And did you ask people why they think the sky is blue?
I did. I went to downtown Chico, right outside of the station, and I brought my recorder, and I asked this question to people, and here's some of their answers.
Why is the sky blue?
The typical response is the sun reflects off the ocean.
Does God made it blue? I don't know.
Because the sky is blue because it reflects from the water molecules and how they break down the light from the ocean and the sky?
I don't really know, actually.
It has to be something to do with the atmosphere.
It reflects light. It's the light reflecting off the atmosphere. The specific frequencies.
I believe it's something about fracturing light.
The light hits our atmosphere, and our atmosphere refracts the light and separates it out so that what we actually see is the visible color of blue.
Because we definitely live in the eye of a blue-eyed giant.
So, what do you think? Did anyone come close?
Well, the last one was the most entertaining, but not really. They're interesting and typical responses. I've heard these over the years many, many times. It turns out that if you were to check out what's one of the most Googled questions of all time, it's this one. Why is the sky blue?
So why is the sky blue then?
Well, Matt, it has to do with a concept called scattering. I heard in the responses from some of the folks you talked to a couple of words like refraction. Well, that means bending. And I heard reflection. That means bouncing like off a mirror. And they missed the point, which is what really is happening is called scattering, which is called Rayleigh scattering, named after a 19th century physicist named Lord Rayleigh. And what he determined is that the wavelengths of light scatter selectively based on their length. So like the blue light is much, much shorter wavelengths. There's many more of them that pass by you in a given second than the red light, which has got a longer wavelength, a more gentle curving path, if you will. And so fewer of those red wavelengths will pass by you in a given time period, a second. We call that a frequency. So the blue light's got a much higher frequency than the red light. So it collides much more often with the molecules in the sky, the nitrogen and the oxygen, than the red light does. So the blue light, it's colliding with many more of the molecules in the atmosphere. It's scattering more. So when we look up in the sky during the day, we see more blue light. In the evening, when there's more air for the sunlight to pass through because it's a longer path, if you think about like straight up overhead, there's not as much air as when you look off to the side towards the horizon. There's much more atmosphere for the light to pass through. Then the only wavelengths of light that get to your eye are the reddish ones. So you see colors at sunset that are reds and orange and yellows. So blue sky during the day, reddish color, orange color during the evening and morning.
Cool. Well, thanks for answering that, Dave. If you have a question that you'd like to ask Dave, send us an email to blue.dave@gmail.com and you may hear your question on a future episode. Dave Shlohm is a science educator and host of Blue Dot, the science show about life here on Earth. You can find the podcast at mynspr.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Both The Teachable Moment and Blue Dot are co-productions of North State Public Radio, reminding you that we are all living on a pale blue dot.
Thanks once again to our guest, Robert Stone. You can check out his three-part series, Chasing the Moon, on the PBS program, The American Experience, next week. And there's a companion book Robert co-authored with Alan Andrus, which is available from most major booksellers. Blue Dot is produced by North State Public Radio. We're distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our assistant producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.